he pulled in to the parking lot at about 9:20 this morning and pulled around back like he's supposed to. There is one parking spot left in the back, which means all of you are doing a wonderful job of helping us out by parking in the back, those of you that are able. We really thought that we had more time to worry about growing pains than we do. I want to say it was Basil Barrett Baxter who said there were five stages of the church building process. There's we don't need it, we can't do it, can't afford it. Now, let's see, it'll never get done. You built it too big and you built it too small are the steps of church building, and it never fails that they surprise you. So we thought we had a couple of years before we had to worry about parking problems, and surprise, here we are. So very grateful to all of you that are helping out with that as we make some time. For the sake of communication, there is a small committee that was formed by the eldership to start looking into long-term solutions for parking and things like that. So they are having a conversation about it, trying to figure out what comes next sooner than we thought. So we're grateful for that. But in the meantime, we're in the business of buying them time so they can figure out what we have to do about where to put cars. Tonight, just to prove I can't do anything in order, we're going to go to Matthew chapter 4. We were in Matthew 17 last week and Matthew 5 before that, so it makes perfect sense to me. I don't see what your problem is, but no, this is what we're doing tonight. Matthew chapter 4, 1 through 11. And then here for a little while, in a couple of weeks, we're going to skip over to John and then come back to Matthew. So, again, it makes sense in my head. It doesn't mean it makes sense to anybody else, but it does. Matthew chapter 4, 1 through 11. This is the temptation of Jesus, and one of my favorite passages to preach through because there are so many great questions that come out of it. So tonight I'm going to do my best. I preached a long time this morning, I noticed. So I'll do my part and bite my tongue tonight. I'm going to try to really make this discussion oriented. I'm going to raise some questions out of the verses that we read, and I'm hoping you'll give some feedback on this rather than me preaching my favorite sermon about it, which I'd like to do. So I'll save that for some other time. Let's take a look at this particular story and in its details. First point comes out of verses 1 through 2. Someone want to read Matthew 4, 1 through 2 for us? James, thank you.
Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights afterward, he was hungry.
Okay, thank you. So pretty straightforward. That just sets the scene for us, and there's a couple of observations I'll make before I ask my question. He is led by the Spirit into the wilderness, so this is something that God wanted to come to pass. This is not some kind of, I don't know if there's such thing as accident, but it's not one. This is something that he was directly led by God to go and do. Led by the Spirit into the conflict, but it's the devil who does the conflict. Starting next week, the auditorium class, we gave Bobby one extra week for Ephesians this morning, but James, the book of James, starts next week, and James chapter 1 teaches that God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. So the Spirit leads you into the wilderness. It's Satan that's doing the deceiving and the tempting, but God does sometimes point us in the direction of conflict, of struggles to overcome. The cross is an example of that. Jesus is pointed to the cross. Is that a struggle? Is that a conflict to be overcome within Jesus? Absolutely. God doesn't tempt him to do evil on the cross. I'm sure Satan did. But God does lead him to struggle. My friend Grant Sullivan over at North Heights in Bixby likes to point out verse 5. The devil took him to the holy city and to the pinnacle of the temple. And as my buddy Grant says, the Spirit led him to the wilderness. The devil took him to church. And I don't know what you're supposed to make out of that. Grant thinks that's really funny, so I repeat it so often. But it's funny what places you find temptation in. The wilderness was a place of temptation. The devil took him to the church, to the holy place, right, the temple, and tempted him there. Maybe there isn't a safe place. The fasting, 40 days and 40 nights, what does that remind us of? We think of a handful of Old Testament stories. Moses on the mountain, Elijah fasts at one point in his career. Let's see, or is it Elisha? One of the prophets who start with E fasted for for 40 days and 40 nights. And I apologize, I forget which one. Read your whole Old Testament, you'll find it. But yeah, this is something that connects to Old Testament passages of people beginning a life of leadership. I makes me think it's Elisha. Anyway, leadership is anticipated by fasting. You're shaking your head. Is it Elijah? It's Elijah. James says it's Elijah. I'm going to bet he's right. So in any event, Old Testament figures doing that, and so Jesus does this. In all of the Gospels, it's towards the beginning of his ministry. Matthew, it's Matthew chapter 4. So right out of the baptistry in chapter 3, right out of the river and into the wilderness is the way Matthew has it. You come up out of the water and you go into the conflict. It's the beginning of a life in conflict with Satan. Before, you weren't in conflict with Satan. You were doing exactly what he wanted. Now, you are in a life of conflict with Satan. In Mark's gospel, it's in chapter 1. I mean, it's just the very first thing. He's baptized, and then he goes to the wilderness, and then he's off casting out demons before the chapter's over. Very quick. Luke has it a little bit later. I had to look. The question for discussion is, why is this necessary? Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have the temptation of Jesus. It all has pretty similar story. Now, Mark just says he went and he was tempted. It doesn't give you the details, but Matthew and Luke give you the same temptations, same details. Why is it necessary, why is it important for God to show us that Jesus was tempted like this? James?
So he could represent us.
Okay. So he could represent us, and you might be thinking along the lines of, like, the book of Hebrews talks about he's a high priest. We have not a high priest who cannot be touched by the feelings of our infirmities, but in all points like as we are, is tempted, yet without sin. Yeah. That sounds like Hebrews. I think that's right. So yeah, the New Testament teaches that he represents us and goes through the same struggle of us. So that calls to mind that representation of Christ. What might we think if this hadn't happened? Kind of related to that. Jim? So, yeah, we would be inclined to think, well, Jesus just doesn't know. Jesus never went through it. This is a great excuse that we use all the time when someone tells us to do something we don't want to do. Well, you don't know what it's like to be me, right? And so, of course, we would tell Jesus that if we had the opportunity. Instead, God shows us he knows exactly what it's like to be you. Satan picked on him in particular. And here are some examples. So I think that's part of it. The ascetic Gnostics in the end of the first century and the second century believed Jesus didn't have any flesh. He was purely spirit. You can't tempt him that way. I mean, you can't tempt him. He can't be hungry. The verse says he's hungry, right? You can't tempt somebody who can't feel pain. Jesus feels pain. So this, again, counters the notion that we might have had of Jesus, of this not just a perfect figure, but a figure who couldn't have been any other way. He kind of cheated. He played the divine trump card whenever he was tempted. No, he was tempted as a human being in the flesh. Todd?
So that it doesn't matter what kind of ideology you're being preached, as long as you're being promised food, you're going to listen. And so I think at this end of this 40 days and 40 nights of fasting, since Jesus Christ is in the human form, and he is susceptible to those same human feelings and emotions and stuff, that at the end of those 40 days, he is physically at his most weakest point. Where if there was any time he was going to be susceptible to temptation through physical weakness, this would have probably been that point.
To add to that, in Luke's account, now I'm going to cheat and just mention Luke here. In Luke's account, the temptations are in a different order. It's the same three, but they're in a different order. And the very first one starts with the word again. Again, Satan came to him. What's the first one? And what it seems to imply is that these three temptations were on repeat. That again and again, Satan comes to him with the same temptation, and again and again. So if you're hungry on day 14, and Satan says, turn these stones into bread, what when he comes back on day 28? What about on day 39? You start to question your sanity, don't you? So yeah. Day two, Jim? Day two, I'm done. Yeah, I know. That's yep. Okay, good thoughts. So what we're going to do with each of the three temptations in Matthew, we're going to talk about it. I'm going to read the text, and then I've got the same three questions about each of these temptations. They range in difficulty, but I know you can do it. Okay. Number one question is going to be, from what desire does the temptation arise? So temptation is when there's something you desire that is being used to deceive you or lure you into doing something you shouldn't. So what temptation is being appealed to here? Jim gave us a hint when he referenced 1 John chapter 2, the lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. That's a convenient way of kind of breaking these down, but we'll want you to expand on that a little. Question 2, what is the sin under consideration? What is Jesus being asked to do that is wrong to do? Okay. And then number 3, what does Jesus' response mean? We're all very happy that he quotes scripture to each of these temptations, which is its own sermon, right? The Bible helps you ward off temptation. But sometimes it's more obvious than others. Why did he quote that one? Why is that helpful? What's the point of that? So those are my three questions. Let's start with the first one, verses 3 through 4. And the tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread. But he answered, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Question 1, this is the low-hanging fruit on this one's pretty easy. From what desire is he being tempted here? Hunger, yeah, okay, hunger. Just a reminder, there's nothing wrong with desire. God made you to desire things. The problem is that when Satan uses something you desire to entice you to do something you shouldn't, hunger is a very natural thing. We'd be in trouble without it, right? It tells us time to eat. Okay. So hunger is the desire that's being used by Satan to lure him into something. Which brings us to question 2, into what? What sin is Satan enticing him to commit?
This has always been a question for me.
Well, it's me too. That's why I put a question mark on it. You're supposed to have answers.
If you're hungry, and, you can turn these to bread. Or why didn't you do it before?
Uh-huh. More than that, Jesus has done this very thing on a regular basis in the Gospels. He turns water into wine. He takes a basket full of food and feeds a few thousand, right? Jesus is more than capable of creating food for various occasions for other people. What is he being asked to do here that would be sinful? Lenora has the answer.
He would be using a miracle for his own benefit.
Okay.
And none of the others were like that.
So one difference between all the stories I just told you and this one, Lenore says, is that this would be entirely for his own benefit. I don't know whether he had any of the wine he made or not, but in principle, it was made for the wedding feast, and I don't know if he had any bread and fish, but in principle, it was for the hungry people. It wasn't self-satisfying, right? So the other examples are things for other people. This would have been entirely for himself. Is that wrong? What sin is that? What is the name of the sin of feeding yourself? I'm making you work hard, aren't I? Yeah. So I tend to agree. That is one observation that is important. There is a difference between the times he's done it for other people and doing it for himself. But in and of itself, it's not a sin to feed yourself if you have the power. You had a hand, and then Jim had a hand. Did you have a hand?
Would that be along the lines of envy? anything that really you're not supposed to have, or maybe this is
okay.
not the way God intended for you to have that.
Getting closer, I think. Envy would be wanting what somebody else has or desiring it maybe in an inappropriate way to the degree that you would do something you shouldn't to get it. So that seems to be close, right? That there's why, though, is it inappropriate for Jesus to have it in this way, Jim and then Edwin? Okay. Again, I'm going to say get partial credit because I agree that in some way this behavior is going to put him under the influence of Satan more than of God. But again, why? Because I'm going to go home and have dinner tonight. It's not going to put me under Satan's power. It normally doesn't. In fact, God would say, Paul would say, that everything is good as if it's received with thanksgiving. Okay. So what's the problem here? Edwin and then Todd. Fix it, Edwin.
This may be a stretch, but...
I like a good stretch. Let's see.
When I read it, I read, if Jesus gives in, then there's reliance on self. Right?
Okay.
I'm relying on myself to satisfy my needs rather than relying on the Father who will provide for me even through this hardship.
Yeah. You're getting closer all the time. I'm so excited. You're very close. I think that's part of it. Absolutely, that it's part of dependence on God, right? And that Satan is encouraging him to depend on self. Take your own power and do this. Why is that a problem in this story? Todd was next. Okay, then stop then.
And so I think he, you know, was seeing if he could stir up an anger or some kind of, he's patronizing him. I said, you know, I'm not just talking to any individual here or someone who claims to be a sorcerer that can do this. You know, you claim to be the Son of God.
Especially in the context of Matthew 3, where the last thing that happened in Matthew 3 was Christ is baptized, the sky opens up and says, "This is my Son." And then Satan says, "Well, if you're the Son." So it is definitely a provocation that's rooted in if you are who you say you are, if you are who the sky says you are, if you are who God says you are. It is a challenge. I think the word, just to move us along a little bit faster, the word we're maybe not using is the word fast. He's fasting. What is a fast? Yeah, it is a period of time where for the sake of stressing your dependence on God, you do not provide for yourself. It was to encourage you to remember in prayer and in supplication that you are completely dependent on God and to kind of mute your own desires in order to pay more attention to that. And it was an oath. You don't have to fast. But if you took an oath to fast, on day two, Jim gets hungry. When he decides to eat, now that he's fasting, the problem is not that he's hungry. The problem is that he's made an oath. I mean, he has sworn to God, for 40 days I will keep this fast and I will depend on you and I will look to get you. And on day two, he says, "Boy, I'm really hungry though." Or on day 39, he says, "Boy, I'm really hungry." So the question is about dependence on God because it's during a fast. If this was an ordinary Tuesday, Jesus making himself a sandwich isn't necessarily a problem. You do this all the time. But once you say, for the purpose of calling my attention to God, I declare a fast. You devote yourself to God and then back out on it because it's too difficult.
But I thought the fast was over.
Is it?
Well, he says afterward.
Yeah, chapter 2, he's finished the fast. He's done it 40 days. And afterward, he was hungry.
Yeah, in Luke's account, and I'm cheating again. In Luke's account, it's definitely during maybe towards the end of that 40-day period, but it's before the fast is over. Because at the end, in verse 11, it's the angels that attend to him. He has not been attending to himself, right? He is still in the wilderness. If the fast is over, he can really just go make a sandwich. I mean, why is he still hungry if the fast is over? That it has to do with this is still during the period of the fast. It's after he's gone into the wilderness, but it's before the end of the fast. It's in that period of time, is the way I would read that. Lenora shakes her head no. Which verse are you looking at?
I'm looking at Luke 4. In those days, the second verse, and in those days he ate nothing.
Yes.
When they had ended, he was hungry.
Huh, so it is the very end, isn't it? Interesting. So I had taken from verse 13 in Luke that this is part of the verse 14. Jesus returns, so he hasn't returned yet. Would we say this is the very end? Because in verse 14 he goes back. Right, he's been in the wilderness 40 days, and then he returns. And Matthew reads very similar. I thought in verse 11. Then the devil left him. Behold, the angels come and are ministering to him. Verse 12, now he heard, he withdrew into Galilee. So the next story hasn't started yet. This is still the period of fasting, even if it's at the end perhaps. But, interesting. See, now that's not fair. If I ask hard questions, you're supposed to answer them, not ask hard ones back. Well, it depends on how you interpret both of them. Yeah, but. Yeah. Interesting.
And what's the reason for the fast anyway?
Yeah, what is the reason for the fast?
Why did he fast that long? The purpose of fasting is, as I understand it, part of it is dedication.
Mm-hmm.
He should know that what's about to happen to his life, and he's getting ready to go on his ministry, and this is preparatory for everything that he's going to be going through. Success and the failures and the rejection and everything. And I also get from this, since this is recorded with three different authors, nobody else is with him. Who's going to know this? So it's written that we and whoever read this can know that because he went through this and was successful, he is the Son of God.
Okay. None of that answered my question, but that was very good observations. I like that. Yeah, so I am stumped now a little bit about where in the period of fasting we are. That's very interesting. So if, for those of you that are convinced that this is after the 40 days, what sin would you say he is committing?
He tempted his pride. He said,
if you are the God, Son of God. So it's about pride.
And obedience to God.
What do you mean, obedience to God?
To be the Son of God and obey him.
Obey him how? I mean, in what way is he being asked to be disobedient?
Well, he says, if you are the Son of God.
Yes.
He questions him whether he is the Son of God at this concept.
Okay. So why, based on that, is it a sin to turn stones into bread? So again, it's based on pride that it's
It
was an appeal to pride. Okay.
What's the way of Satan to get him to end his fasting too?
Not if it's over. They told me it's over. You're on a different conversation. They said it's over. I've got to answer one question first before
it's
I get.
Over, then,
yeah.
Okay, it's done. Go ahead. Turn these stones to bread.
Yeah.
You're done. Finish it. Come on.
It's interesting. If it's over, that is a different spin on it. Real quickly, I in theory had two more temptations to cover. Apparently, that's not going to happen. I haven't figured this one out yet. Let me just move ahead just a little bit for the sake of, we have 10 minutes left and 10 more verses. What does Jesus' response mean then when he says, man shall not live by bread alone, by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God? Connect the dots to me. You're fasting. Either the fasting is over or it's just about over, depending on which person you are in the room. And then, if you're the Son of God, provoking his pride, turn these stones into bread, and Jesus says this. What's the connection? Larry, you've had your hand up a couple of times, but I know I've changed subjects a couple of times too. I'm sorry. Yeah, he's still hungry. There's no question he's hungry, whether it's...
In the desert, even though he was out and it ended, he still may not have eaten yet. But the devil, what he did in this case, he said, hey, we've tried everything else. I'm going to have to do this myself. So he was going to try to personally push him over the edge, and it didn't work. He didn't forsake his God and listen to the devil.
Again, I'm going to ask, if the fast is over, why is turning stones into bread forsaking God? Edwin, you had your hand up. I appreciate your comment. That's good stuff. I'm just trying to connect the dots.
But I mean, just to even listen to me, he's saying, you don't live by bread alone. In other words, get out of here. You know, I'm not listening to you. You got no bearing on me.
Okay. So that's his way of saying, I listen to God, not you, regardless of whether I'm hungry. Okay. Edwin? You get last one. I've got to move on.
But. Well, I'm trying to figure out which question I'm supposed to be attending.
All the above. Just say something smarter than I have for 25 minutes, and you get a gold star.
So kind of piggyback on some of the points that have been made. So why, when Satan prompts Jesus or any of us, do we have to respond?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Why do we have to? Why does Jesus have to prove he is the Son of God?
Right.
And Satan. That would be my response.
Yeah.
Question.
And that connects some to what Lenora has said. You know, that kind of connects the idea of this, and over here, well, this is about pride and provocation and responding to that. Other miracles were for other people. This would be an entirely selfish act just to respond to Satan, to which he says, yeah, I don't need food for that. I can listen to the Word of God. Interesting. Okay. I thought that was the easy one. Shows what I know. Number two. Verses 5 through 7. I'll read the verses because that much I know is right. The rest of it I don't know. Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. So, same questions. What's the desire that Satan is appealing to? Personally, I don't have any desire to fling myself off of a high place. So what desire is he appealing to here? Why would anyone want to do this? Why is this tempting? Somebody say pride again? Because you're right. Here, definitely, it does seem to have something to do about pride. Because you can. It starts again with, if you're the Son of God. If you are who you say you are, show me. Right? Let's try this. Doesn't the scripture say about you that you could fling yourself down and angels would catch you? Doesn't it say that? I've joked before that this is the first example of the prosperity gospel ever being preached. That you just fling yourself off the temple and God will catch you. You just write the check and he'll cash it. Right? This is the first example of false promises from the gospel. Anyway, James, yeah. Maybe sowing doubt. If you really believed it, wouldn't you do this? Maybe you don't even believe you are who you say you are. Because if you did, wouldn't you do this over here? That seems like a Son of God-like thing to do to me. And even with to make a broader point about the previous slide that I said I'm not going back to, the stones into bread, If he can do that, why doesn't he feed everybody? I mean, if he's the Son of God and he loves Israel, why doesn't he turn all the stones into bread and feed all the people? Why is there hunger in the world? If you are who you say you are, think about the power you have. Why don't you use it? Why don't you do something with it? The Pharisees say they're going to kill you and you run to the next town. Why don't you just fling yourself off the temple? God will catch you. Why are you worried about anybody? Jim?
Yeah. He did it on an individual basis, and he did it to show that he was who he said that he was.
Yeah.
And with Satan or with the devil, why would he want to waste his time doing that? Because the devil knew he was the Son of God. There was no question in the devil's mind. And so he was trying to, he was provoking Christ to do things, as I see it, just to prove that he. He didn't, even when he was talking upon his, right before the crucifixion, you're the Son of God, son, say so. He didn't stand up and proclaim that, did he?
Yeah.
He just said, son, say that.
So I think this, yeah, I think you're right. This is connected to this craving for proof that what you've shown me isn't sufficient yet. And why would I? And then for Jesus, why would I waste my time showing you more? In John's gospel, you don't get the temptations. But you do get people constantly coming to Jesus after he does a miracle saying, show us a sign. And quite often Jesus says no. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. So again, to me, there's a connection in the two stories. You know, why after he does something, in fact, in John's gospel in chapter 6, after he feeds the thousands, the next chapter, they say, show us a sign. So even if he did turn stones into bread, it wouldn't make you happy anyway. You know, it wouldn't satisfy you. Go ahead.
That's kind of what I was going to say. It quench enough.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it tells us that whatever man asks for and he gets, he's not satisfied.
Yeah. And at some point, it's more about me showing you. It's more about pride than it is about convincing you, because you're past the point. There's been sufficient information to convince you, and you're just not interested. Yeah. Herod wanted to show. Remember at the trial of Jesus? They take him to Herod, and Herod says, do one of those things you do. Do one of those signs, right? And Jesus doesn't do anything for him either. Herod gets bored and sends him back to Pilate. Yeah. Okay, so something to do with pride is the desire. The sin would be something to do with pride as well. What does Jesus mean when he responds? Again, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. Why is that the answer? And I think you're on the right track with what you said before, that that's what has been going on here. It's not about, I'm an honest searcher for truth, and I need sufficient evidence to convince me. This has been about, for the sake of my pride, show me another. And at some point, you're just provoking God. You're not depending on God. You're just asking for more. The word provocation, this don't test the Lord your God, is taken from an account dealing with the children of Israel in the wilderness. And what did they always say? Oh, well, better we'd have been back in Egypt, you know. Why doesn't God do something good? Well, think of all the things he did for them. Brings them out of Egypt, 10 plagues, parts the sea, and they get in the wilderness and said, boy, God doesn't do nothing for us. Right? And so we don't test the Lord our God. We don't, when with all he's done for us, at some point it's a point of pride about personal satisfaction to ask for more. Throw me off the temple? Throw myself off the temple? What does that prove? Yeah. Okay. I'm out of time. Okay. Tonight there's just two temptations of Jesus. Sorry. I'll just read these verses and ask kind of the same questions. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these I will give you if you fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. That one's a little more obvious because Satan directly asks for something that is forbidden. Worship me. Which makes us wonder, based on our discussion tonight, was that kind of the implied point in the others? You know, that you are relying on Satan in some way or doing this worship Satan. Because this is exactly what Christ is going to get. This is what's interesting. All the kingdoms of the world do belong to Christ. He said so. All authority is given to me in heaven and earth. After the resurrection, it was true. Satan says, worship me and you can have it now. We can skip the cross. We can skip the misery part. You can just have it now, the easy way. Instead, Jesus opts for the other. We worship God alone, and if that means suffering, then that's the way it goes. And then the angels attend to him. I had more questions. We're out of time. Very good discussion tonight. I'm going to go back and study this and wipe the tears from my eyes that you scolded me good. So a lot to learn here. Appreciate your comments.